You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hello, 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 everybody, and welcome to another great episode of Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with Susan Giddings.
Hi.
Another fantastic show for everybody today. I know that we're going to talk about the administrative remedy process, and that is looking forward to what Susan has to say. You know, we have several clients, usually at least one ongoing, if not more, at any given time, where we're providing guidance through a family member or third party, of course, but we're providing guidance on administrative remedies on a variety of topics. So I can't wait to get this refresher from Susan on that, because sometimes I still get a little bit confused on the how many days for the 9 and the 10 and the 11 and stuff like that. So it you're going to want to pay attention to that. But before we do that, Susan, you want to talk about our book on the First Step Act CRAD. The second edition is doing very well.
It's doing very well.
And what is our placing?
We were last time I checked, we were like number 31 in legal self-help, which is, you know, fantastic. We're just 2 weeks in. And then a little over 2 weeks, right?
Right.
Can't remember what day. And then this past week, you know, we went ahead and released the Kindle version, the e-copy version. Mm-hmm. So we took the older version offline. And so you want to make sure when you're Googling Amazon, searching Amazon, that you look for that second edition with the big gray seal that says second edition on it. Because if you stumble on the old site, it will say out of print. So, So we wanted to, we made the decision to go ahead and do that, and got that out this past week, last week, right at the end of last week, it went out. I think it was. And so that was great. I like books. I'm not a fan of the e-version, but, you know, you can look at it portrait, or you can rotate your tablet landscape and zoom in and zoom out and all that fun stuff. But I'm kind of old school. I like books.
Yeah, for sure. You'd be able to refer to something and go back and earmark it and highlight
it. Tabs in it, highlight, put notes in the margins, you know. It's a lost art with the kids with, you know, they want to.
It is.
Do stuff electronically. You know,
we have whatever modality that you like. So
absolutely.
There's some exciting things about the conditional calculator and some other stuff.
Yeah.
That's not
touched on DC code cases. You know, they're still out there waiting and hoping to get credit. And unfortunately, DC console needs to do, my opinion, DC console needs to do a better job at writing some statute, because the way they wrote it, anybody convicted in the last 25 years isn't actually eligible for credit.
It's crazy.
So maybe they call us and we can talk to them about that too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, without further ado.
In the First Step Act credit book, we actually talk about the administrative remedy process a little bit. And we talk about how to approach it regarding specifically, you know, the First Step Act and going through that informal resolution process into the formal process. And you're right, you know, at any given time, we probably have one or two clients. Oddly enough, we have three or four right now.
Yeah.
I think we have three right now at the BP-10 level, which of course, you know, we always talk about never give up at the 9 level. I think we talked about in the last show when we talked about our cases, we mentioned that about the importance of the BP-10 level. But, yes. You know, in general, we'll jump into, you know, what is administrative remedy? What is that process? And that is a grievance process. So it's used when you as an individual believe the Bureau has made a mistake. We kind of dive into this quite a bit of where it's appropriate and not appropriate to use the administrative remedy in the book. But in a nutshell, it's when the Bureau has made a mistake, or you believe the Bureau has made a mistake. You know, in the book, we use the example of if you've been convicted of a 924C, which we all know is not eligible for time credits, filing administrative remedy on that issue is a waste of time because the Bureau has correctly determined you to be ineligible because of that. But when their mistake occurs, you know, obviously the goal is always to solve the problem at the lowest level. So, you know, even before getting to the informal resolution process, now, mind you, you need to kind of move quickly because you got 20 days, but you should at least attempt to talk to your case manager, right? Or if it's something with psychology or education, talk to those people. You know, give it the college try. Give it at least one try to talk to them about it. And if you don't make progress, then you want to jump into that informal resolution process because that's your clock, right? We talk to a lot of folks about that timeline. Talk to someone today about the timeline. And, you know, our question was, when did the team tell them they weren't going to do this? And it was the 21st. And I'm like, okay, that's your clock. You have 20 days. That initial filing, that informal resolution, getting with the correctional counselor in the institutions, they refer to that process as like a BP8, BP8.5. It's usually a single page, locally printed form, and it's only got a couple of lines for issue and request. One of the things that, and we've seen some folks who have sent us copies of their administrative remedy that go on and on and on. You want to like be short, sweet, and to the point. Before we jump into the kind of the specifics on how to do that, I think real quickly we'll go through those timelines. So you have those first 20 days. You file your administrative remedy. When you get that response back, you're going to turn around and you're going to file that BP9 if it's denied. Now, if that administrative remedy informal process goes on for weeks, right? Mm-hmm. And then it comes back. Your 20 days for that initial filing include your informal resolution. But if your informal resolution takes an extra long time, that is grounds for an extension. So always, 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 when you are in a situation with an extension, before you jump into what the problem is, you are asking for an extension. This happened on this date. I saw my counselor on this date. I completed an informal resolution. I did not receive a response until this date. And you kind of hit that right off the top. So anyway, so you get your BP9 and the institution has 20 days to respond. They can also get, and I'm going to like really quickly look at my cheat sheet here, 20 days to on an extension. So when you submit your BP9, submit to the correctional counselor, individual gets a receipt, a printed form that said, yes, it was received and this is when it's due. That document is your contract with the Bureau, right? They're going to provide you a response within 20 days. If they need to request if they need an extension and they can get an additional 20-day extension, you're going to get another printout that says an extension has been issued. The due date is this. Why do you want to keep those paperwork? Because if you don't get a response on time, as the individual, you should consider that a denial and move to the 10. You don't have to wait forever to get a response. They've got 20 days and then 20 days of an extension. So go ahead.
If the Bureau doesn't do anything, then you can move right on to the next one, to the 10.
Yep.
All right.
Okay. So then when it comes time to the BP, so now you're moving on to that BP 10. You have 20 days from either the date of that last extension or the date on the administrative remedy, the date that the warden signs it. You have 20 days to get your response together, get in the mail, and get it to your regional office. For individuals, let me back up just a second. For individuals sitting out in the community in halfway house and home confinement, you don't have to do informal resolution. you can do your BP9 directly to your residential reentry management office. Okay. And then the region, so you have 20 days to get it back to them. They have 30 days to respond and an additional 30 days for an extension. Your correctional counselor in the institution should be providing you that receipt and, if necessary, that extension. So when you're sitting there, you're collecting your documents. You know, hey, I mailed it last week. Counselor Smith, can you check to see if Region received it? And they can check it, pull it up. Yep, here's your receipt. It's due to you by this date. As that date's approaching, if you haven't received anything, back to the correctional counselor. Hey, correctional counselor Smith, my BP10 is due Thursday. I haven't received anything. Did they issue an extension? Again, that correctional counselor can look that up. If there's an extension been issued, there'll be a new receipt to give you, and that's going to have a new date. And then the last step is within the Bureau is the BP11, and that is to the Central Office, General Counsel's Office. That is the last level of review. And again, you as the individual have 30 days to get your paperwork together and send it off to Central Office. They have 40 days to respond and 20 days on an extension. Now, you might be sitting there thinking, well, why does it matter if they get an extension? They're the last level. Why do I have to worry about that? Because if you're going to pursue action through the court, if you're going to file a habeas, if you have not exhausted administrative remedy, the first thing the Bureau is going to say is, you didn't exhaust administrative remedy. When I was still working, we had a case where the individual skipped the whole admin remedy process and filed a habeas to the court. And I don't even remember which legal office it was, reached out to me, and I looked at it. And you know what? He was right. He had a mistake with his FSA. Got it fixed because that was part of my job. And then we wrote a declaration. And in the course of my declaration, I said, had he gone through the administrative remedy process, we would have identified this sooner and been able to fix it sooner. And of course, the habeas, the declaration, and then the subsequent motion to the court was to dismiss as moot because it was fixed. But if he had just followed the process, like,
man, I'm filing habeas on these people.
Months had gone by. And he didn't talk to, you know, he had done some cop outs, but he never initiated an administrative remedy. He just was like, I need to go to the courts. It's an emergency. And the courts can choose to either accept the rationale and kind of dismiss the Bureau's claim of not exhausting administrative remedy, or they can come back and say, he didn't go through administrative remedy. We haven't even had a chance to, he hasn't even brought this to our attention. And the courts can throw out the case, and then he's wasted more time.
Yeah, I've
just, you know, they can grant the Bureau's motion to dismiss and tell him go through administrative remedy. So the timelines are important to pay attention and to keep those documents. You know, one of the things we talk about in the book is you keep all your documentation. When it comes to administrative remedy, you know, excuse me, you can do up to a single continuation page. And if you do, you have to make the four copies. But you only have to attach one copy of your evidence, of your exhibits. But they don't return them. So before you shove things in the mail or hand stuff off to your correctional counselor, making copies, always retain your own copies. Always, always, always. Always.
Have you noticed any common complaints both ways where there was a mistake and it gets fixed? And then the most common thing where there's an allegation of a mistake and they're just, it's just never, no, it's just completely got nothing coming type stuff.
Right. So, when I was in, worked in the regional office, administrative remedies, I didn't do all of them, but I had certain ones. And two areas that I did a lot of work with was financial responsibility program and custody classification. One of the things that I did, and there were times where, you know, the inmate was correct. There were times the institution was correct. There were times that the institution was correct, but for the wrong reason. But when I got, and this is my own cautionary tale, when I would get an administrative remedy and I was then reviewing it, I wasn't just looking at that one element. So you said my history of violence is wrong. It's serious. It should be minor. I'm not just going to look. I literally will review the entire custody classification. And I can't tell you the number of times I found a different error. So it was kind of a wash. They might have been right here, but there was an error over here that was in their favor and shouldn't have been. And yeah, which is the same thing I did as a case management coordinator in the institution. I had people come to me at Mainline to complain about their case manager. And I'd be like, if I'm going to look at it, I'm going to look at the whole thing, make sure right. It's right. You know?
Right.
So, but you know, some, you know, the more complex the issue, the more discretion there is, you know, the more, you know, if it's cut and dry, you have a 924C, you're ineligible. That's pretty straightforward.
Or the days that you're in transit.
Right. Or your day, yeah. You know, those are straightforward things. But if you're talking about, we've had some habeases recently that actually the individuals won on their case. In fact, this is actually some new content we added in the new book, having to do with individuals with an 841 B1C enhancement for serious bodily injury or death. There was one case that went as far as the district court. And then there was another case that kind of got resolved at a lower level. And both of them had to do with the way the judgment was written and then the penalty information. And I will be honest, I looked at them and I probably, from the bureau side of it, I probably would have scored them the same way. I probably would have found the individuals ineligible. And it really took kind of when the courts came back and were like, they explained their the one case that went to the district level, you know, what they were looking at. It really took a lot of people sitting down and looking at and saying, okay, if this is the case, how do we translate that from complex legal language to something that a case manager can look at and go, oh, okay, just because it says serious bodily injury or death doesn't necessarily mean it is. And that's it was kind of a kooky part of the way they wrote the law with the penalty statute. So going back to the law needs to be simplified, but that's another story.
Good luck with that. Yeah.
Hey, good luck with that. That's something we're working on. That's something we really want to see is some simplification there. Right. But I think the biggest problem, back to my days as a case management coordinator looking at BP9s and then as a senior specialist in the regional office looking at BP10s, is they're not written in a straightforward manner. You know, I would get a BP9 or a BP10, and for those not familiar with the forms, they are in a colored form, old fashioned carbonless copy, multi page document. The BP9s are blue, the BP10s are yellow, and the BP11s are pink. And they are the top half of the form is for the inmate's complaint. And the bottom half is supposedly where the institution would type in their response. And of course, in the days of now that we all use computers. Nobody actually types in that lower half back in the day, in the dark ages, when we still had typewriters. Those responses were typed directly onto those forms. But now they're a separate document. But the form itself is still used, and it's still, you have a half a page on the actual form and one continuation page. And when you see folks just going on and, you know, you're not getting paid by the word. Like, what is the issue? What is the policy citation? What do you want? I am being held to a serious history of violence for this. This is the offense conduct says X. This is what the policy says. It should be very specific. I also always recommend, when you're citing from your pre-sentence investigation report, page and paragraph. We do that when we're providing guidance, and you know, and we just did one recently with the PSR, and we went and page such and such, paragraph such and such says X. And that's what it should be. It's that simple, straightforward.
Right.
This is not Moby Dick or the Grapes of Wrath. We're not getting paid by the word. The simpler and more straightforward it is, the less likely the point is lost.
Now, okay, so I'm just going to take a shot at it, because it's been a while, because mine would be at the region. You know, I was in the region, and folks would get a little sideways about firearm stuff, two-point enhancement, not getting 3621E, and then if they did get it, you know, we had to wait till they were through their community treatment and all this other stuff. But what about some of the folks that are lengthy? You have this lengthy response, and they're actually asserting two or three things, and maybe one of them is correct, but three of them are just dead wrong.
So the policy says you can include more than one issue if they're closely related. So if my custody classification is wrong, and that makes my pattern wrong, which makes my risk level wrong, those are all related. Or my risk level is wrong, therefore I'm not getting my time credits, and my unit team should be talking about halfway house, and they're not, because they're saying I don't release to out here, but if they fix this other stuff, my release date's going to move up. Those are closely related. If it's unrelated, if it's just out of left field, I'm talking about my drug eligibility, and I throw in something with medical, they can reject it.
Right.
And again,
right. Based on, there you go.
They can reject it. And then, you know, you're eating your time up. You got to turn around and you've got to resubmit it.
Exactly.
You can't just blather on of that staff's being mean. You know, we had a conversation. We had a client that, his running argument was, I'm telling the truth and they're lying. But he had nothing, zero, to support that. And we had a good conversation with the family.
Yeah.
And we said he's got to provide something. Yeah. In the scope of his BP10. BP9, I don't know. No, he did it as a DHO. It was a DHO. In the BP10, he made reference to a written statement he provided the hearing officer. It wasn't attached to the 10. We don't know if it was literally there was nothing. Right. Going back to the save everything.
Right.
If you're going to provide if you're going to a DHO hearing, and you're providing the DHO with a statement,
right,
have a copy of it.
Definitely.
You know, that documenting things are important. I would also, you know, one of the other things just in general we recommend in the book, separate from administrative remedy, is keeping a calendar. And I know that might sound kind of you know, kind of business-like to keep a calendar in prison. But, you know, when were you on, you know, when did you go for call-outs? If you're having a medical issue and you go to sick call on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday,
and
you're waiting for a call-out and you don't have one, document. And then when you do get a call out, you go see, well, who did you go see and what day was it? I had, I saw a medical on Thursday, the 15th at 2 o'clock. They did this, you know, they did this, this, and this, and they said to come back in 5 days if I wasn't feeling better. Came to call out on such and such date. You know, we don't do a whole lot with medical stuff because that's really beyond our history in terms of our experience, but the same thing applies. Document, document, document.
In terms of keeping track of things.
In terms of keeping track, you know.
Very factual.
Same thing with incident reports. You know, if you had a call out, I would even go so far if I was sitting there in an institution and the call out at 7 o'clock in the evening, and it wasn't on the board at 7, and I checked it at 8, and I checked it at 10 before we locked in, I would be annotating that there was no call out posted in my, so that if something happened, if I then miss an appointment the next day, call out's not posted, talk to Officer Smith, evening watch.
I mean, you know, yeah.
I would keep track of everything. I mean, mistakes happen. We're still dealing. I'm not suggesting in any way that the staff are being mean, the staff are being non-responsive, but they're human beings and mistakes happen. We regularly see things that are a mistake and it's having a negative impact on the inmate. And we're like, this is a simple mistake that just needs corrected.
Right.
This wasn't anything. We're not saying anybody was being malevolent. We're not saying anyone's being, you know, unprofessional, but you're a human being and you make mistakes. And I think we all need to recognize that. I had one of my work friends used to say, staff aren't always right. Inmates aren't always wrong. And he was a lawyer. And so as a lawyer in the regional office, he saw a lot of things where mistakes happen. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important. But understanding what is an administrative issue and what is not. Now, along with what's an administrative issue and what's not, what kind of remedies can you ask for? Asking for $1 million is not the appropriate venue for administrative remedy. If you really believe you are entitled to a cash
claim,
a cash payment for whatever, then file a tort. Do not file administrative remedy because that's not what it's for. If your only remedy is the staff member should be fired, they're going to take your information in and you'll get a response that says something along the lines of, you know, we'll look into it. We take all issues, you know, allegations of staff misconduct seriously, but you will not be advised of the outcome. And that's the end of it.
Right.
If you focus on the paperwork, the decision that was made, I was found to be ineligible for RDAP. I was found to be ineligible for FSA. I was only recommended for 60 days of halfway house.
I'm thinking of some of the correspondence that I sent up today to a couple of regions and whatnot. It's like we're doing the same thing in our advocacy for the client, saying, this is the issue, right? This is the mistake. Here's the issue. Here's where things might have gone wrong. Here's what we're looking at restoration,
right?
Restoration of the mistake and moving forward. Thank you very much. Thank you in advance. And we
had some issues where they didn't actually have to go as far as administrative remedy. We we gave them some guidance language and said, okay, this is what you're going to do. And did it through the cop-out process, didn't even get as far as the administrative remedy and got it fixed because it was a simple mistake. Depending on whether it's at initial classification and, you know, you're dealing with folks at DSCC that might have just finished training last week, you know.
Right.
Or they might have been there for 10 years. We have a case right now, and you and I haven't even discussed it fully, co-defendants, and they've been scored differently. And we're working on that. And we got one of them got partly corrected, and it's in the administrative remedy process now. Okay. And the other, we've got that will probably may or may not have to go as far as because the tough part is has already been resolved. So we're hoping that he'll get his situation resolved. And again, it just comes down to the experience level of the person looking at it and their point of view.
Yeah. And try to make your statement or argument, I don't want to say argument, but airtight, just real clean, real obvious, right? Because like you said, if it is a younger staff member or whatever, that they can read what it is, and then they can check with somebody or their supervisor or supervisors or whatever, then they can kind of get the information that they need. And so that's...
And some of the issues are really complex. And that administrative remedy process is good for everybody. You know, I flash back to my Carswell days. and when VICLA first rolled out, that's how old I am. When VICLA first rolled out and what is a crime of violence? You know, today a crime of violence is pretty simple and straightforward, at least from the Bureau's perspective. Maybe other arenas, it's different, but at least from the Bureau perspective, they've been using the categorization of offense policy since the late 90s and with very little change. And had a case early on. It was a violation of civil rights with an underlying conviction. The underlying conviction was arson. Was a female. She wasn't actually the one setting fire. She was sitting in the truck. And
she
was one of my Carswell ladies. Up on 2 North. And, you know, she was actually young thing. She was under 25 and she was actually, sitting in the pickup truck while her boyfriend and brother were out causing trouble. And all three of them were prosecuted. And I remember telling her, you know what, this is a brand new law. I think I'm right, but go ahead and file administrative remedy and don't stop at the 9 level, keep going. and eventually it did go all the way to the central office level and they concurred with my initial assessment of it. But it wasn't easy because one of the problems in that particular case was when they made reference to the underlying offense, they didn't talk about the statute, right? And if you remember flashback to the categorization of offense policy, you got section 3, that's these are always violent. And then you have section 4, the next section of 3, the back half of section 3 is these are sometimes violent. And it depends on the underlying offenses and the conduct. And then you get into section 4, that's director's discretion. Well, this was in the second half of section 3. But all of categorization of offenses is by the U.S. code.
Right.
And I didn't have the U.S. code. I had the sentencing guideline information. So there I was at my desk with my sentencing guideline book, cross-referencing against my policy.
The blue one.
Yep. Going back and forth. And, it was not easy. I don't even know if they print them anymore.
I think I have one in the other room.
I don't even think they print them anymore. Everything's online now.
I know, but yeah.
But yeah, I had to go back and forth because the PSR did not cite the underlying statute. It cited the underlining sentencing guideline. So, yeah, so I had to do this cross-referencing from the guidelines back to the statute, over to the policy. It was painful. It was traumatic.
But at least you're doing, you know, you were doing your job to take a look at the statute. Same thing with certain types of 2113 bank robbery, this or A or B or C. Now we have these 841A1B, you know, all these different things that are out there, even with a couple of different sex offenses that are actually eligible. And so it is interesting to drill down into the statute.
Right. Well, and if you remember, I'll flash, you may or may not remember it, but I kept my response for a long time. When I was a case management coordinator, we had a case where we had rejected mail for continuing criminal activity. And it was a sex offender who was on a, I can't remember what they called the plan, but outlines what they're not allowed to have and what they're not allowed to do, a management plan for a sex offender.
Right.
And the content that he had sent in, while appearing innocuous, actually fell under his can't have list. And I had reached out to you for some language when I was working on the BP9 response.
Oh.
And the funny, and he knew he couldn't have them.
Right.
I mean, but I was being mean. I was being
right.
Racist and sexist. And I don't know what else I was being at the time. And so I had a very detailed response, citing the policy, citing some other stuff, some language you had helped assisted me with. That was back when you were in the region.
Yep,
and, and when we rejected it when we did it at the informal level, he turned around and filed a 9, not on the issue, but my response cited his PSR, which is appropriate for my response.
Absolutely.
And of course it was then rejected because now you were filing a 9 on a different issue that you hadn't done informal resolution on. I mean, he knew he was hit and he was trying to circumvent
plan. Stick to the facts, stick to the very clear and concise issue. You go down these other subjective things, or you get in your feelings, or you're feeling some kind of way, you know, that you're going to lose.
Yep.
You know, every time. And so you win based on the facts and a very clear evidence picture. And anyway.
And we've seen some of those 9s that have come to us where they started the process and then they wanted to talk to us about it. And we're reading the 9 and they literally undercut their own argument in their own statement. And that's because they were getting into their feelings and they were going off on tangents. And the cleaner and shorter you keep it, the tighter you keep it, the more likely you are to not.
And that's why, as consultants for these issues, it's a good thing, because you're going to minimize some trial and error. You're going to have fresh, and I want to say objective eyes, right? Because we understand both sides of the picture. Here,
right?
You know,
and we're not emotionally invested in it. We have that emotional distance and to look at the facts, and we've had to tell people, you don't have a basis to file.
You got nothing coming. Yeah, I mean, and we'll tell them up front. You know, we're just not going to string you along. Whatever, you got nothing. I don't want to waste your time, and man, I sure as heck don't want you to waste ours. You know, so
absolutely,
I think it's we've really, really helped. There's been a couple of times we've had the luxury of responding to somebody's issue, we were able to hit 2 or 3 different people at different levels at the same time. Oh, boy. Now when other people are watching this, right, when you got different levels of staff watching this kind of live theater, shit gets real. You know, it gets real. You know what I mean? So in a good way, right? Because that person responding is going to be like, so what'd you do with that? You know what I mean? Or, hey, we saw that email this morning up here, and what do you think is going to happen with that?
We had a case that the institution provided a 100% incorrect answer in a BP9. And I really, I felt bad because I actually knew the person because they were working when I was still working, because I'm not that far removed. And I was like, oh, you let your warden sign this. We had to, you know, basically we spelled out where they made a mistake, yeah. You know, and, you know, there was that part of me, cause like I said, I'm not that far removed from active duty. Right. And I really felt bad as a regional person when I would get the BP-10 and I have the institution's response and I'm reading the institution's response and I'm like, oh, they let the warden sign that. I would pick up the phone and I would call the case management coordinator or the associate warden or whoever I needed to. And it'd be like, okay, so your case manager needs a training moment.
The cream pie is headed to the,
you know, I'm like, so this is what was put in there. And, you know, and some institutions, like this was a pet peeve of mine when I was working, custody classification, you file on it, it gets assigned to a unit manager. Yeah. And who writes the response? The case manager that made the original decision.
Right.
And then it goes to the unit manager, and then they may or may not route it through the case management coordinator.
Exactly.
And if something was routed to me as a case management coordinator and it was wrong, like I would catch it, but I invariably would see, and I'd call the CMC. I'm like, hey, do you know if this was routed through you? Did you see this? And it'd be like, no. I keep telling them, let me look at custody classifications, because that was the one I dealt with the most.
Hey, this is for our staff members out there at the 12, 13, 14, 15 level, you know, watch what you're signing, okay? Mm. There is no rubber stamp. And look, there I was, 1992, in an institution where, on some days I was fourth in charge or what, just, you know what I mean? Cause if a couple of people above me were sick, man, all of a sudden I'm signing stuff. I had no bit, you know what I mean? You know, I had no bit, I
wouldn't say I had
no business, but yeah, I just got out of Glencoe. You know, they would say, you're so young, you're still pooping Glencoe chow. Well, you know, so be it. I was, but I was that first year, obviously, but you know, but then after I got burned, when a unit manager, oh, man, we're good. I got burned. I'm like, nope, screw that. And I double, triple, you know, whenever I signed something, I went to a CMC, or actually I had another staff member there that was an exec that had a huge, wonderful case management guru, you know, training. And I would talk to that individual, and then because you know what, I'm putting my name on this, right? And I'm saying it, you know, and I'm representing the institution. And before it goes to the region, you know, I learned to take that stuff real seriously, real quick. It only took me one moment on the stove to get that hand burned, but anyhow.
Because here's the other thing. Is when that goes through the administrative remedy process and goes all the way up the chain. And then if the decision is made by the individual, by the incarcerated individual, to file a habeas, and all of those become documents for the
court.
Who's
going to court or having to make a statement? Yeah.
Yeah. And going back to, as you said, staff members that might be out there watching this, like, do you really want your name on a piece of paper that has typos, that's incorrect? This recent case regarding the 841 B1C, the court just, oh my gosh, the court just tore up the agency because of the administrative remedy responses that were in there where, you know, they made, and I was just like, mm-hmm. I'm reading this. I'm like, mm-hmm. who let that go? Like who signed that? You know, you know, the decision was based on the sentence computation data sheet. No, decision is never based on the sentence computation data sheet. that's just a bunch of information. But anyway, but yeah, whether, but that goes for the inmates as well. When you're writing something, make sure you've done your homework. And if that means you're sitting in the law library reading policy, or you're involving someone like Bruce and I, you got to do your homework. You lose credibility. I had an administrator.
We're at 4 minutes. We're at 4 minutes now.
Oh, same. Okay, then never mind. I'll tell the story later.
All right. But anyway, long story short, folks, hey, honor the timelines. Take notes. Keep a calendar. Keep your evidence. Make copies because you don't get the stuff back. Be factual. Try to be as factual and succinct as possible in your writing.
Your documents. PSR, page, paragraph. Policy, page, paragraph.
Yep. And that will at least assist you in improving your chances of getting a good result. Because as a reader, and you and I were readers, where I was like, oh, okay, here we go. And you see this New Testament size, you're like, here we go, man. And you just put the negative hat on. You know what I mean? It's like, here we go. And you just kind of just click off the wrong stuff. You don't want to do that. Just make it easy for staff to make the right decision.
Absolutely.
Get you restored. So awesome. So again, folks, just another great little discussion we had. Don't hesitate to ask us questions on our Facebook group. Mm-hmm. Ask us questions on YouTube videos as they're posted. Federalprisonauthority.com is our website. Our early release from Federal Prison First Step Act is our Facebook group. Our YouTube channel is First Step Act. And so we got a lot of different touch points for you. So if you haven't joined our group, please do. Glad to do that. And of course, all of our podcasts are available now on Apple Podcasts and Amazon Canada for some reason. And a couple of other aggregators are picking us up each week.
We just had someone purchase a book from Canada.
Hey,
I just happened to notice it this morning.
I mean, and we're getting some listeners and viewers in Canada. So
very exciting.
It is. They must hear your accent.
Just kidding. I don't have an accent. I'm from Ohio.
Hey, that's pretty.
I'm from
Texas,
Ohio.
From Dallas. That's Canada. From
actually,
from Dallas,
what's funny is people here think I sound like a Southerner because I've spent the last however many decades living in the South. So you want to put a plug in for the book?
Do it.
We have our federal prison, Unlocking Federal Time Credits. And that is the Blue Book second edition that's the first edition there. You look for the gray silver label, and then Unlocking Classification and Federal Designation. Great book. If you are,
beginning your journey,
yep. For attorneys out there listening, great book to make sure that PSR is in the best position for your clients. And that's about it. Some good stuff out there.
Awesome. Okay, then got the books. We got everything. Okay, folks. So you want to be with us next week here on Around the Block and see if we have a guest. We have some guests in the works, so they're going to be awesome. You're going to want to talk to them. They have a lot of experience. Mm-hmm. And we're getting those guests booked here in the next week or two. So that's exciting.
Excellent.
Otherwise, we'll bring out another facet or another issue that's going on. We'll look at the posts and we'll see what's going on with everybody, and we'll talk about that. So, all right, everybody. Okay. So have a blessed week, and we'll see y'all here next time on Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block. Take care, everybody. Be safe. See you next
Bye-bye.
Time.
Bye-bye. Take care.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.